My name is Michael Rees. I'm a program manager in the big data team, owning the UC Equal Language. And I'm going to present today a couple of scenarios that I've, many of which I've actually not presented before. So you're kind of the first people that get to see some of the code here. Even Brian, who is my team member here sitting in the front row, hasn't seen most of it yet. So let's see how the code will work and look like. Just to give you an overview, today we are going to go through four kind of scenarios that uSQL is kind of designed to address. The first one is doing some custom row set processing using what we call a custom row set aggregation or a reducer. The second one is going to show you how to do JSON processing utilizing the JSON capabilities that we have published on our GitHub site. The third item is a little bit doing image processing. Not the super cool sentiment analysis image processing thing that you might have seen in the keynote, but kind of a little bit more down to earth using standard feature extractions, EXIF data extractions, thumbnail creation type stuff. And then last but not least, I also show you how to call R from uSQL. Not R server, but just how to deploy an R runtime and then do that. This is going to be pretty like diving into the deep end of the pool. So if you want to have an introduction to uSQL and you have missed yesterday's presentation, please go and watch the video or the recording, or come and join the Ignite conference where I basically give a longer version of that presentation on Thursday. So just as a kind of a caveat here. So the core aspect that makes all of these scenarios possible that I'm going to talk about is the uSQL extensibility mechanisms that uSQL provides. It starts out with uSQL being based on the C-sharp type system and therefore allowing you to write C-sharp expressions inside your uSQL scripts as the scalar expression language. However, obviously, if you want to start making reuse of your code that you're writing, you want to be able to package it up in user-defined functions, which we'll be seeing a few today. And then also, once you want to do more complex processing, where you want to go over multiple rows, if you want to produce more rows or reduce to less rows, but your logic is predicated upon making use of some either existing or freshly written code, then you have to use the what we call user-defined operator framework, or UDOs. And that's going to be a big part of today's presentation. So what are UDOs? UDOs are either the ability for you to write schematizers yourself that take a file and make row sets out of the file content, or going the other way, taking a row set and producing a file format that might not be the standard CSV format that we support. Then you have the ability to use user-defined processes, which take one row and produce one zero or one row. And you have the ability there to either do things that just pass through columns or that transform columns into something else. And we'll talk more into like when this is advantageous over, for example, user-defined functions. You can also do user-defined appliers, which takes one row and returns multiple rows. You normally use that in the conjunction with a cross-apply expression inside your uSQL select statement. And then finally, you have the user-defined combiners and user-defined reducers. Combiners are basically a little bit like user-defined joins. So they allow you to take two row sets and produce a row set out of it, and then the implementation is basically your C-sharp processing. And finally, user-defined reducers are taking n rows and return m rows back. Now, normally the result is smaller than what you pass in, but there is no like guarantee that this is the case. So if you produce more than more rows out, at that point in time, you might want to make sure that you are hinting some row count or so. Otherwise, the optimizer might make some assumptions that may not be what you're kind of hoping to get. And besides implementing that in C-sharp, you have now expressions in the uSQL language that give you the tie-in into the uSQL script flow as well as giving you the abstraction that does the scale out for you. So while you're writing an extractor, for example, you're not writing it with knowing how many nodes it has to run over. It basically, the only thing you say is, does it have to see a file in its entirety or not? And if it's not, it will get scaled out once the file hits 250 megabytes of size or so. Here is a quick UDO model breakdown. You don't have to necessarily read the details on the code here. You will see that later when we go through code as well. But just to kind of give you the category, kind of the items that you have to work through. So the first thing is you mark a UDO. The way that you mark it is that you implement an interface, for example, an iExtractor interface. In addition, you can put attributes at the top. Secondly, you parameterize the UDO. So you can use a class initializer that then basically is being used to parameterize it, and you can put some private global class variables in so that you can keep state between the initialization and the actual application. Then you have the UDO signature, which is specific. So an extractor, obviously, you override the extract that returns a set of rows and takes an unstructured reader in, as well as an updatable output row. And then it's basically an accumulator that accumulates the output rows as you like process row by row. And then finally, you have your UDO-specific processing pattern, which you are implementing then basically your custom logic in. So it's a fairly easy extensibility model, and it's kind of repeated for each one of the UDOs, obviously specific to the UDO's semantic. And finally, in all the UDOs, you always have access on the row sets, both in terms of what writing into the row sets, but you also can look at and take action on basis of the row set schema. So you can always see what is not only the input row set in terms of its value, but you can also see what is the name of the column that you're passing in, what is the type of the column that you're passing in, what is the name of the column that you're expecting on the output, what is the type of the column that you're expecting on the output. So you can build very complicated and generic processors and extractors, et cetera, which give you a lot of flexibility. However, as you will see, most of the time, the things that you write are actually looking pretty simple. How do you specify UDOs? You will see both of those during the demos. The first one is our Visual Studio tooling has a notion of what we call a code behind. Code behind is just the file that is somewhat tied to your script in the Visual Studio development experience. And you can put your code in there. And when you deploy it, the tooling will basically create the assemblies and tie everything together for you. And we'll take a look at that during a demo to kind of see how that actually happens in real time. The second one is that you can actually create a class project inside your solution. There is a class project for USQL. Don't just take a C# project. It has to be a class project for USQL so that you get all the dependencies done, the kind of predefined using statements, as well as that you get the right clickability to register it as an assembly inside the data lake. So, and once you do that, you will have to go over and do an explicit reference inside your USQL script after you register the C# class project yourself inside the data lake. I will talk about that too during the demos. The main reason why you might want to do it, splitting it like this, is that you want to share the assembly with others. So the kind of code behind is good for ad hoc playing around with it, and only you are kind of using it, and you want to have just the solution together. Or if you want to like deploy this into the store and other people want to use it inside your organization, then basically doing it this way is a better way of doing it. So you will see a lot of C# code in the demos. However, you can use any .NET language in theory. So you can use, for example, Iron Python or what is a favorite one of some people. I think there was something called F#. That we got a lot of feedback on at some point. You can write your extractors user-defined functions in F-sharp if you want to. However, these languages are not first-class in tooling, so you have to do a little bit more than that. You have still to use the uSQL-specific .NET libraries. You have to include them into your project. You still have to implement those interfaces. Only now you implement them in these other .NET languages. And then you have to compile the DLL. You have to upload the DLL into the Azure Data Lake store yourself, and then have to write a short script to kind of register the DLL out of the data lake. And we'll see that as well, how that's being done, how to write those scripts. So in terms of managing assemblies in the script, you write a create assembly statement. We'll see those going forward. You can also include additional resource files. We'll make use of that as well. So we'll see that. And then once you use them in a script, which is a separate step, so you only have to register it once. And then once it's registered, you can reuse it as you go along over your time writing new scripts. So you only have to register it once and not in every script. I've seen some people do that they do it in every script because the demo script that they have seen was doing it in the same script. And that's not the best practice here. You can also reference .NET framework assemblies. Many of them are preloaded, but because we want to minimize the amount of data that we have to load onto every vertex when we're executing that in scale-out, some of the other system libraries might not be preloaded, and at that point in time, you basically have to say reference system assembly, and then we make sure that they get deployed as well. If you want to see which assemblies you have an SDK that allows you to do enumeration of metadata objects, that also allows you to enumerate what assemblies are there. For example, PowerShell commands are provided for doing that. And in the uSQL Studio Server Explorer, I will show you how you can look at them. And there you even have nice integration with Visual Studio, so you can like do some reflection on that. And then if you are finished using an assembly and don't want to use it anymore, you can drop it as well. And Visual Studio will be very easy to do that. Now, once you register your assembly, all your namespaces will become available inside your uSQL statement. And some of these namespaces might be like multi, like microsoft.samples.analytics.formats.json, etc. And after a while, you get like your hands get tired. So we're giving you a using statement that is similar to the using statement in C#, except for that it's uppercased using, and that gives you the ability to basically short form your class names and your namespace names. So now let's look at some code. Enough talking here. The first example that I do is basically showing you how I can use uSQL as extensibility to do something that is called overlapping range aggregation. The use case here is that maybe a bunch of users interact with a service, and you kind of, among other things, log when they start interacting and when they stop interacting. And maybe some of these users might use different sessions to interact with the service, so they get overlapping interactions. And so what I want to do is I want to merge that into the longest contiguous overlapping interaction sessions for each of the users. So in this example, if you look at the person ABC, the person ABC basically does from 5 a.m. to 6 a.m., but then from 8 a.m. up until basically, 2 p.m., or from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m., but in overlapping sessions. So there are many of them in the input. So how do I do that? One way of doing that is that you order the data, and then you basically go through the data and find the overlapping, like as long as they are overlapping, you're kind of adding to them, and you output once you don't see a next overlapping item. So that's kind of what the aggregation would do. But the important aspect there is that you need to order the data first, and we don't have what we call ordered aggregation in the user-defined aggregator space, but we can do this with what we call a reducer. The link that you see here at the bottom is a link that takes you through the blog post that actually talks you through that example in a lot of detail. So let me go and switch over to the code first and show you the code
Visual Studio. And if you look at the code here, it's a very simple U-SQL script that you see. First, I schematize my text file that contains these ranges. And I just use a standard text extractor here, uses a non-standard delimiter. It's using a dash. And then I do the reduction. Now, what this reduction does is it basically takes the begin daytime and end daytime and the user, and it partitions that input data and produces the same schema again, and then it partitions it on user. So that means every user will get its own reducer instance. Now, in this case, I don't have a lot of data, so everything will be running in one instance. But if I have, let's say, a really long log history of a very successful service or so, this might go into the megabytes, gigabytes, potentially even terabytes of data. And at that point in time, the partitioning that I do on user is both good and bad because it allows me to scale out. Each partition will have to can be processed individually on a per user basis, but I might have data skew in that because one user might be very active with the service and another user might only come to the service once in every like 2 months or so. So in order to be able to do that, if the reducer is capable of basically being associative, meaning I can do sub-aggregations and then aggregate the results of these sub-aggregations, I can build what is called a recursive reducer, which then allows me to partition even the data on these really huge data sets into smaller units so I can get better scale. And we give you all that framework and I will take you through. Now, here in this case, the only thing I have to say is pre-sort on the begin value so I get it ordered. And I partition on user. And then the produce section just tells me what is the output schema. Because it's a recursive reducer, it has to be the same as the input, obviously. And then I say that the user column, I'm not aggregating on. I'm just passing that through. And this is actually very important because it allows the query optimizer to push predicates through. And we'll see that with that currently commented out example down here on line 12, where I say, only show me the result for the user ABC. Now, normally, user code is not accessible to the optimizer. So the optimizer doesn't know if the user gets changed inside it or not. And by basically saying that it's read-only, I basically tell the optimizer, it's fine if I have a predicate on the user. I can move that before the reducer, which obviously will be very beneficial because it reduces all the amount of data that gets processed inside that custom code. So let's take a look at first the job execution. I've already executed it a little bit earlier today. And so this is basically the job execution. It looks very simple. It gives you one vertex here that does everything, the extraction, the processing, and the outputting. And if I double click on this, you notice here, let me zoom in quickly. You see here the input, the extraction that gives me the schema, then the sort, which is the pre-sort that is being specified, then the reducer, and then the output. It's all in one vertex, basically. Now, if I run the script here with the selection active, then the script looks slightly different. The script looks on the outside the same, but now if I go into the node, you will see that there is now a filter transformer. And the filter transformer happens before the sort and happens before the range reducer. And that's important because that gives me the performance and scalability that I expect from a fairly good system in that context. So, last step, how does actually the reducer look like? Well, that's C#. So in this case, I did use the code behind. So you see here, there is a script.usql.cs, which is the code behind file. And that contains the reducer. So you introduce some namespace. You can choose whatever name you like. And then you implement basically a class of the iReducer interface. You mark it as a SQL user defined reducers up here, and because in this case, I have an associative semantics of the processing, and I can have the same input as the same output, I can make it recursive, so that gives me better scalability. And then in this case, I don't have any parameters, so I don't have to set the parameterization, and I just override the reduce method on the interface. And then in here, this is just the standard processing here. So you see here, get date, it's getting the data, and it basically does all the processing that I mentioned earlier to kind of accumulate overlapping ranges. And then at the end, I'm basically outputting either when the previous interval is done, I output the result, or if the end, of course, I have the last sentinel that I need to output as well. Now, when I submit this script, you notice in the script, I don't have any reference assembly. The only thing I have here is saying using new reduce sample range reducer. And so the system, when it submits the script, needs to do something. And so what it needs to do, we see when we look at the actual submitted script. So this is the script that gets actually submitted. And you will notice at the beginning you have the create assembly statement, which has some weird name, plus some binary string, which is the actual content of the assembly. And then it does a reference of that assembly. So what that does is it basically loads the assembly into the metadata store and makes it accessible with the reference statement for the compiler to resolve the names and then for the runtime to actually execute the code. And if you go down to the end, you will see code behind footer that basically does the cleanup, that drops the assembly again. So now, of course, once you want to kind of use the assembly forever, then at that point in time, you probably don't want to have this kind of hanging around. OK, so let's quickly go through here. We already talked about this. So pre-sort does the pre-sort of the input. The partition and scale is being done based on the reduction location. So you can either say on something, then that's partitioned. If you say reduce all, then one single vertex will see all the data, unless it's a recursive one. And then you basically declare the pass-through, which is important for optimization. And you have your user-defined reducer. In the code itself, you basically say if it works, if it's associative and has the same input-output schema, then you can specify that it's recursive, which gives better scalability. You implement the iReducer interface. In particular, you override the method. You have input row set partitions that you can access. So input is basically where you get the input data, and you can just loop over it on a row-by-row basis. You can get the columns, and you can set the output columns as well on the output schema. And as I mentioned, you can even drill into the input and output to see the schema context, like what is the name of the column, what is the type of the column, if you want to do specific processing based on the expectations that people provide. And then the yield return is basically always accumulating the rows for until the input rows have been consumed, and then the reducer basically passes on to the next stage inside the vertex. Any questions so far? So then let me go on and talk a little bit about the JSON processing. Here the question is basically, how do I extract data from JSON documents? Unfortunately, not everybody is in the CSV world. A lot of people are using JSON or XML for moving data about. And so you want to have a way of extracting that information as well. Now, the JSON extractor that I'm going to show you and the JSON functions are available on our GitHub site on the link below here that you see on the slide. So if you want to go and play around with that later, you can do so. The samples are not yet up, but will be up once I finished writing the blog post about them, which might be tomorrow or might be a month from now. OK, so let me switch over to the code again. And find here first. So let me first talk you a little bit through the JSON assembly. So this is the project that we have on the GitHub. You see two folders, JSON and XML. The JSON folder contains basically the JSON extractor, a very simple JSON output where it just gives you a flat row kind of view of the data, and the JSON functions that you can use inside. And then the same we have for XML. I'm not going to dive into the XML one here. So what you do here is basically you take your JSON outputter. Let's go to the extractor first. Kind of go up here. So the JSON extractor is a very simple extractor. It takes a path that identifies which location inside my JSON document is going to map into a row during the extraction phase. And then you have the optional ability to provide basically local locations by the schema. So the extract gives you the schema. It says person ID, camera model, whatever. And it basically will then look for that subfield inside that node to see if it can take that out of the node and move it into basically that cell inside the row set. Now, that means that the only thing that you can map out of these rows are JSON objects. So if you have an array or so, you basically have to, or just a scalar value, you have to move up to the object level to be able to like extract it that way. Otherwise, you just use a string on the whole thing and then just use the JSON tuple function that we go and talk to about later to get at the values. So if you look at this here, this is just some code. It's using internally the Newtonsoft JSON library. So we are basically just using an existing library that somebody else wrote out in the community to do the JSON processing for us. So let's go and take a look at the examples here. Might be a little bit more interesting than looking at this code. And here's a JSON example. For this example, I have some interesting input data. So the first JSON document here, and again, I'm kind of operating here on small documents, but obviously, if you have larger documents, it will work as well. This is a very simple kind of single object. We have an object that has an asset object within. So the object itself is a camera object. It has some ID revision information, and then it has the actual camera object inside that tells me about manufacturer, model, type, etc. So a very simple nested structure. How do I extract this? Well, one way of extracting this is to basically go and say, give me the ID, revision, and camera, which are the top-level elements, as string from the extractor. And in this case, I don't give a path, so I'm basically taking it from the top of the document. But now this camera, of course, is again a JSON document. So how do I get at the properties on that JSON document? Well, I can go and use the JSON function, JSON tuple. Now, the JSON tuple function is interesting. It gives me, if I don't provide any path arguments, it will give me all the sub-elements of that object as key-value pairs. Or if it's an array, it will give me a key-value pair of position and value. So it basically gives me the ability to fully decompose the JSON structure at the next level. Now, in this case, since I only have one camera kind of object and I don't have multiple camera objects, I can do that with an inline in the select statement. If I have multiple of those, I should then basically use a cross-apply so I can apply it against every row. If I go down here, then once I have the map, I then can basically just use the standard map lookup to basically give me the values out of the result. So let me run this quickly locally here. I'm running this on my local cluster or on my local machine here. Runs a little bit quicker. And so while it's building, let me also quickly show how I'm calling in. So as you can see, I have registered the Newtonsoft.json assembly inside a database inside my data lake store, and I did the same for that formats assembly. So basically, you download them and you register them. There's a blog post out that explains how we do that. This is now local run, so it's showing you first the command run. It works, and then you see there are two output files here. So let's look at the, for example, information here. And now that shows you basically all the information that I had flat now inside that JSON document. And you can do that, of course, at scale as well. Now let's look at the next example. This is a little bit more complicated. This example here has some nested arrays. And now I basically go and extract from this nested array. Because I have an array at the top, I can specify a JSON path expression that says, give me the array here. So now I'm basically getting, and I'm only extracting the field twos out of the array. So if you look here, I have two elements in that array. The first one has field one and field two, and the second one has field two only. And so if I run this, I would be getting that result back. So let's quickly submit it locally. Just to show you that I'm actually doing what I'm promising to do here. And if I double click down here, now the preview here is a little bit broken because it has carriage return line feeds in it. But you now see that I get basically the field two, I get the, these two fields back. So now let's look at the more complex JSON example here. This is a more complex example. So that's kind of taking the things, the two things that we have seen together. So in this case, I have an array of objects, which itself have some nested properties that are arrays again. So that's kind of a little bit more complicated. So I now have a person, a list of persons, and each of the persons have maybe a home address and a work address. And they're both called address in the JSON document. So let's look at how I process this. So in this case, I want the persons inside the array. So I basically use here a JPath expression that says, give me the array elements and give me the persons within the array. And then out of these persons, extract me the person ID as an integer, the name as a string, and the addresses as a string. Then in the next transformation, I go and say, well, these addresses are actually, again, interesting map, basically maps. So I can extract the address from this map using the JSON tuple function here. And so now I have all the addresses within the addresses element. And then in the next one, I go and get at the values within the addresses. Now in this case, though, I have to, because I potentially have an address array here as a string, I have to use the JSON tuple function in the context of a cross-apply. And then I get only, I'm not interested, because it's an array, I'm not interested in like 1, 2, 3, the keys. I'm just interested in the values of the arrays, and I'm not interested in the order of these values. So I'm just adding them to the explode here as well. And so I now have one row per address that I get down here. And then down here, I just promote the properties of the addresses that I'm interested in. So let's run that quickly as well. If I look at the result here, you now see that basically I have four rows, two rows per each person for each of the addresses. So it's kind of unpivoting that nested structure into the right row set. And then last but not least, you might have cases where you have either multiple JSON documents, or you have the need of having one file containing JSON documents, one JSON document per line. Now, in this case, in the first case, you could use file sets that we talked about in my presentation yesterday so that you can apply the extractor over all the files that satisfy the predicate. And then you have one document inside a file. So you can do this in this case here. So you do an extract over this using the JSON extractor here. And then you drill in into, for example, the message object. What this thing here does, for example, here I provide an additional JSON path expression that says, no, don't give me just the key value pairs of the top level objects. Give me the key value pairs of every object nested within that subtree. And then I can use the path expressions as part of my key on the map to extract the properties, for example, the sub-properties that I have here. And then the second example is if I actually have more than one JSON document inside a file, assuming there is no carriage return line feed inside the JSON document, I can just use the standard extractor to get one line per JSON document. That will be limited to a 128 kilobytes because string data type sizes are currently 128 kilobytes. And then I can just use the JSON function tuple to kind of do the same extraction that I did before. So this is kind of showing you a little bit kind of what you can do with the JSON processing here. It's a very powerful, very simple kind of library that you can do a lot of stuff with. The way that you do it is basically you have this Newtonsoft JSON library that exists out there. We didn't touch it except for we copied it over and loaded it into the data lake, plus our analytic sample formats library that we have on the GitHub side. If you have single JSON documents, use the JSON extractor. If you have multiple JSON documents, either first do not allow carriage return line feed inside your JSON. Use the built-in text extractor to extract or build your own extractor based on the extractor that that we have in the GitHub site. Now, one caveat with the GitHub extractor is that we are currently loading the full JSON document into main memory. So we are kind of using the DOM approach in that sense. Now, that works with JSON documents of a few hundred kilobyte size, but if you have megabytes or even gigabyte-sized JSON documents, at that point in time, you're going to explode the memory. And then you probably will have to write your own JSON extractor that is using the JSON reader interface. We're actually having somebody, I think, that is currently working on that to contribute back to the community. So maybe in a month or so, that will be available as well. I think I went over this already. So just for people that want to kind of go through the slide at their own pace again, it's kind of telling you exactly how we are basically processing that one step at a time inside your SQL script. Now let's go to the next sample. The next sample is image processing. So let's assume you have a couple of pictures and you want to find out, let's assume for now they're all in JPEG, you want to extract some of the EXIF properties out of, and maybe make a thumbnail out of the picture. So you can kind of build an inventory of the pictures that you're operating on. So if we do this, let me go and show you the app here. So obviously you saw the pictures, some cars pictures that I took somewhere. And what we are doing here is now basically as a first step, we also register our assembly. Now here you see the assembly registration. If I have uploaded the assembly file up into the Azure Data Lake myself, this is the script that you basically submit. Not very difficult. You declare, you get the string and where it is, and you create an assembly from that location. Now the first example I want to show you is in this script, I have an extractor that basically goes and extracts both the image data up to 4 megabytes in size, plus the format information from this file pattern. And then what I do in the next step is I apply a user-defined function on the image data to get the different image properties out, like copyright, equipment make, etc. And I only do that for images where I have a JPEG format specified. Maybe let me quickly run this while I'm talking about this. And then I output this into the image property CSV file. I'm again currently running that locally, so we don't have to wait as long. And then secondly, I'm doing the same extraction here only for a gt4.jpg file. And here I use a UDF to scale this image down, and I basically output the file into a thumbnail. Now, this looks pretty usable. However, it has a couple of drawbacks. The first drawback it has is that my image data that I extract can only be 4 megabytes in size. Unfortunately, modern cameras, often even JPEGs, are larger than that. And we'll get to that in a minute, how you can like handle that. Secondly, if I do a lot of these user-defined functions up here, let's go back here to the, not sure I actually submitted it. Let's see. If you see all these functions here, they all operate on the same image. So they will be loading the image into memory for every invocation. And that's also not very good. So you get a lot of memory pressure by doing that, because now your 4 megabyte image is loaded in like 4 instances on each row. So how do you deal with that? Well, the first step is that you can actually do the processing, extracting all the thumbnail and copyrights, etc., using an image processor. So you're creating a UDO that is an image processor. On this one, again, you specify read-only on those columns that are passed through. But you also can specify what the dependencies are. So here you say that image data is used to produce the copyright, equipment make, equipment model, description, and thumbnail. What does that mean? Well, if I now have a query on the next statement, such as that I only want to get the name from that image property, at that point in time, because it knows the dependencies, it will actually do a filter way earlier so that I don't even have to move my image data around, which is a huge saving in cost, because I don't have to move around all these big units of documents anymore. So this is another one of those optimizations that our extensibility framework gives you. Now, let's look at the image extraction code quickly. Let me see. The first image extractor is very simple. It operates at the byte level. Now, because we cannot split an image, we tell the extractor that it needs to see one file at a time. So the whole file will be loaded into one vertex regardless of size. And then what we do is we will be taking that and basically do some image magic using system.drawing and then output the image array as a byte array. So that's a very simple extractor here. Now the image feature, the image processor is a little bit more complicated, but not that more complicated. What it does is basically, down here, it gives me the input of the image data, and now I look for if the output schema is requesting any one of these columns, then I produce them by looking at the image property and put it into the output column. So that gives me actually flexibility. If my processor, my produce statement of the processor, I do not specify, for example, the thumbnail, then the thumbnail will not be get created by the processing. So that's a very simple way of like having some generic processor.
Where are the images staged in this case? Or they have to be loaded up?
So in this case, the images are still staged in the extractor, so they are still flowing through. So you still have that extractor limit of 4 megabytes per image.
But I mean, how does it get from the camera to?
Oh, how do I get it from the camera into the Azure Data Lake? Well, that depends. You could, for example, have an Event Hub stream that gets data from your cameras and loads them into Azure Data Lake storage.
Could you do that with an
image? Yeah, it's just a binary. Assuming the payload, I'm not sure what the payload limitations on the Event Hub is, but theoretically, yes, you can just load data into Azure Data Lake as an image data. In this case, I just uploaded the files myself. But if you want to do that with, let's say, some automatic surveillance camera or something like that, you can do that, definitely. And so in this case, going back now, going to the third and last one on the images, of course, I can do everything in an extractor. Now, if I do everything in the extract statement here, at that point in time, I do not have to worry about the 4 megabyte file limit on the file anymore, hopefully. There's still a limit, but it's much bigger. I think it's somewhere in the gigabyte range or so. So what this now does is it basically reads the whole file into memory in the extraction. And this image extractor, a feature extractor here, is very similar to the two things that we saw before. In this case, I give you the ability to parameterize the extractor with the scale width for your thumbnail. And then what I do here is I do the same thing as the other extractor did, which is basically get me the image. But then I'm looking, if the extractor is asking for any of these properties, then I'm applying the transformation right in the extractor. And that way, I basically then only flow the data that I actually extracted, so I don't have to move the whole image in 4 megabytes chunks through the processing. OK, let's go back here. So this image processing assembly that you saw is basically just using system.drawing and exposes these extractors, output as processes, and user-defined functions. It is also up on the GitHub site, an earlier version. I will upload the new code that I've written over the last couple of days for the demo today, and so you can play with it as well. There are some trade-offs as we talked. So the column memory limit of having 4 megabytes per row, actually, and per column as well in the case of byte array, basically will be leading you to either using the image extractor or the feature extractor approach that I just showed. Also, if you have main memory pressure inside a vertex, a processor is normally better than a UDF. But sometimes it's even better to do everything inside the extractor early on. So now to the end, let me quickly show you R processing. And that's kind of a really advanced way of using our extensibility mechanisms. So in this case, what the use case is, I have basically, 10,473 triples, which are probably some three-dimensional coordinates or so. And what I want to do is I want to calculate the k-mean centroids for a number of centroids that I specify. So in this example here, I say I want to see 4 centroids. And then basically what the output is what you see here, the centroid number and the actual calculated centroid with k-means. Now, k-means is going to be calculated using R. So let's take a look at that quickly. Where is my R? So here I start first with registering assemblies, because this is a little bit more advanced way of using our assemblies infrastructure. What I do here is I basically have an R runtime zipped up. So that's the rbin.zip. Now, R obviously uses R data types and all that stuff. And so because I'm in .NET, I need a wrapper around it that gives me interop to that R engine. And that is also something that somebody already has written, which is called R.NET. Now, R.NET uses two libraries. It has a native library, which is written in native code, C++ probably, plus a C# wrapper. So what I now need to do is, what I do now is I basically register all these three files as the R.NET assembly. Now, what that means is if you do Python, for example, you would have to do similar things. You have a Python runtime. You have an interrupt layer that interrupts Python with C Sharp so that it can call it from within USQL at the moment. Or if you do JavaScript, the same thing, even JVM if you want to. So that's kind of the pattern that you follow here. And then I have some other utilities that I've written, one of which is the utility that actually does the k-means reducer. So let me show you the script first that I'm running here. What the script does is basically it calls out to these three assemblies that I have registered. It has my sample data that I want to cluster. I have my output location here. So what I do here is, and this is just, this extractor here is just a way of showing you how you can build stuff. You don't have to do it this way. What this does is it basically takes each one of the rows out of that CSV file and merges the three columns into a single array. That's just one way of moving basically a matrix about in USQL. You could also still keep it in like three columns if you wanted to. Just that your user-defined operator afterwards needs to be able to handle that correspondingly. So now what I do here is I use another reducer, which is my k-means R reducer, where I specify how many centroids I actually want to have. And in this case, because the data is not partitionable, because I don't have a partition key right now, and unfortunately, k-means calculations are not associative, so I can't calculate a k-means and then create the k-means over the k-means and get the same thing as if I would do a k-means over all the data. I now basically have all the data executed inside one vertex. So that's one limitation. But if you have a partitioning key that you can give, for example, you do it for different categories of data, then of course you can scale out again. And then down here, at the end here, I just do some formatting for the output and basically output the k-means. So the USQL part is very simple. Now, in this case, I wrote a wrapper around my R script. So let's take a look at the R script. That's inside the k-means reducer. Here is the k-means reducer. What it does is it first loads the R runtime so that I have it available to do R processing. So I'm kind of jumping over that here, and it does some data massaging to move my raw set of arrays into a raw input matrix. And then this is basically where I use R here. So down here, I invoke base engine, R engine evaluate, my R query, which is basically this k-means equals k-means of test data and the centers, and then I return the center. So theoretically, you could write such reducers, functions, whatever, depending on what the semantics of your expression is, and expose that in a library so that people can use it in USQL. Or you can build even something generic where you're passing this R statement into the UDF or into the reducer or into the processors so that people can write their own R expression in USQL and call it with these functions. So let's summarize quickly. Here is the architecture. As you can see, the architecture is a little bit more complicated because we are having all these components together. As I mentioned, you can use this approach for other runtimes as well, so it's not just R that you can do so. However, there are some limitations. Like in a UDO, you cannot access external resources. So you can't call to an R server living somewhere right now. We are looking into that in a future release to give you more automatic experiences for this. So what we will do is, over the next couple of weeks probably, is build some more samples on how to use R, Python, JavaScript, and also make them a little bit more generic than this k-means reducer, so to speak, hopefully. If you have any ideas, feel free. You have seen my tweet address and my email address at the beginning of the presentation. Feel free to contact me and tell me your use case, and I will see if I can get somebody to do it. Or if you want to, you can contribute as well. The other thing is that we are looking at making this experience easier so that people that want to call into these languages don't have to build those wrapper and layers, et cetera, themselves, but give us just information that they have something that is written in Java or in Python or in R. And when you refer to it, we will do the wrapping and the type mapping and the runtime deployment for you. Right now, it's a little bit more of a manual process, unfortunately. So to summarize, UDOs are basically the way for you to extend your SQL experience for the data and with the business processes that you need to do. There are some tips around UDOs that you have seen, like read-only clause, require clause, pre-sort on reduce if you want ordered aggregation, cardinality hints if you need to like tell the optimizer what it should do. Sometimes it's better to use alternatives. So basically use these UDOs sparingly and only if the other aspects, for example, cannot give you the semantics or cannot give you the performance and memory handling that these UDOs can give. Here are some additional resources. As I mentioned, many of these things are available either inside the blogs or on our GitHub site, which are the first three links here. Look at the aka.ms ADL feedback page. That's if you have feature requests, if you want us to have kick-ass R integration, kick-ass Python integration, and so on, go and vote these requests up because that helps us in prioritization on the topics. And thank you again for staying with me a little bit over time. I think there's some evaluation that you need to do, so I'm looking forward to hearing your feedback there. And otherwise, I will be here for questions.